station number 9211, reel 3.
Squadron Leader Curtis, Reel 3. You were talking about running exercises and training sessions to keep wireless operators up to the mark.
Mm-hmm.
Were there any significant innovations in the equipment you were carrying that they had to learn about?
The basic equipment, TR 1154, 1155, didn't alter during the time that I was on the squadron. But at one stage we got... very pleased to get some radar equipment called AI, which was, as far as I can see, was basically the same radar equipment used in night fighters, such as bow fighters and mosquitoes, against enemy aircraft. Certain crews got quite intensive training in this, but like all these radar all radar equipment, it was a bit tricky to handle. But as far as I know, from the time that the squadron got this AI equipment, which really meant a radar scan to the rear of the aircraft, no aircraft was lost through fighter action at night. This equipment gave everyone a tremendous feeling of security. The interesting thing was that on one occasion where we had got clobbered and had to land at an aerodrome called Cagliari in Sardinia, the Americans were using exactly the same equipment in bow fighters on the island that we were. And I had long discussions with the navigators using this equipment, and learned quite a lot from them actually at that time. I think that as the war progressed, more and more navigation aids were coming into force, in addition to G and H2S. But I never had any occasion to use them. Although I think that some of the members of the squadron, after they left the squadron, had more and more to do with radar than we had before.
But I think you said you had a certain overlap of duties between the navigator of an aircraft and the wireless operator.
Yes, I don't think in every crew, but in most crews I would have expected that that the wireless operator did help in map reading, particularly on low-level missions, and especially at on bright moonlight nights on these raids. I know that I tried to help a little bit, but of course on daylight raids it was a lot easier. You could help quite a bit by map reading at that on those raids. The navigators and wireless operators did work very closely together. It was a natural thing. The whole idea was to help each other to survive.
Do any particular raids stand out in your mind as being particularly significant?
Yes, significant as far as significant as far as this, as me individual or concerned. Yes, in particular the one on the Dortmund Ems Canal in 1943. The second big raid, as it were, of the squadron, the first being the dams raid. On this occasion, again, low level, all the way across the Low Countries and then into Germany. It really was low level, because one can remember the pilot pulling up to go over high tension cables, so we must have been pretty low. Setting off on a bright, clear moonlight night. Eight Lancasters flying in formations of four each, low level, which again is pretty hairy when you think about it. And just before getting into Germany, we were flying number two. Squadron Leader Holden was the CO at that time, who had taken over Guy Gibson's crew. And just before reaching a small German town, I can't remember the name of it, light flak came up, hit him in the starboard wing. In a matter of seconds, he crashed, exploded, and that was the end of Guy Gibson's crew. We then reformed with Mick Martin taking over as the leader of the section, and then unfortunately running into low-lying mist come fog over the Dortmund area, and then losing the other aircraft and trying to find it on our own as a result of either light flak or maybe crashing because of flying so low in bad visibility. We lost, I think it was six out of the eight aircraft that night. That was a big blow to the squadron, because nearly all, so many of the original people had gone down that night. And it seemed to alter the thinking of the powers that be to get the squadron off the ground and up into the normal bombing heights. That was a very traumatic experience.
Was it thought that the main source of these losses, or cause of these losses, was the light flak or flying accident?
Well, I'm not quite sure. I would personally think it was 50-50. I know that light flak, if they just catch you low down, you've very little chance if they just get you lined up. But at the same time, the weather was particularly bad that night, and trying to find a canal, although I've seen it since the war, I was amazed how big it was. It's very difficult to find these things. I mean, we did find it. But after stooging around for maybe up to an hour, which was hairy. The other bad experience that that we had, really, on the as far as I'm concerned, and the crew for that matter, was attacking a viaduct called the Anthiore Viaduct in the south of France, where I think from memory that the Germans were bringing troops and equipment through to go up into Italy. And we had the job of knocking this thing out. Again, another one of these low-level efforts. And on this occasion we went in very low and got problems from an awful lot of searchlights, which made it very difficult to see anything, and being hit very hard with by anti-aircraft fire, and unfortunately we had one shell that came inside and exploded inside the aircraft, which injured the bomb aimer. Who hadn't at this time been able to drop his markers or bombs, and injured the engineer, and I'm not quite sure whether it injured the pilot. No, I don't think it did, actually. I'm not quite sure about that. I know. I remember the rear gunner saying something about he was getting wet in the in the turret, because by this time, of course, we were heading out to sea from the viaduct, and that was the only time that I've ever sent an SOS in the thing, and I was very pleased to say that it came. The replies came back straight away, and they sent us on to Corsica. Then I contacted the airport at aerodrome at Corsica, and who then said they didn't have any facilities there, and sent us on to Sardinia, where we eventually landed.
If someone was injured when you were in the air, was there anything you could do for them? Was there a first aid kit or anything like that on board?
Oh yes, in this instance, the pilot told me to go forward and have a look, and which I did, because the engineer couldn't do much because he was he'd been wounded, and when I got to the bomb aimer, I reported that he seemed to be okay. He was warm, but what I hadn't realised that he'd got this electrically heated flying suit on, which kept him warm. And then when we gave him a shot of morphia. He was unconscious, of course. In fact, at that time he was probably dead because he got a big hole, as I remember, a big hole in his chest, and big hole in his head as well. We didn't have any. We had no training in that sort of thing. But one at least knew that morphia would help. We presumed.
What about the flight engineer? Was he in a bad way?
No. He was hit in the leg. But like all these things, your imagination works overtime, and the remarkable thing was about while all this was going on, trying very hard to get across the sea to Sardinia, that everyone was so efficient. This is the thing that, which again, it must be the mark of a well-trained crew. Everyone did the job the way it should be done. I was very proud to, you know, be a member of this crew. When we got to Elmas Field was the name of the aerodrome. When we got there, we found that the, apart from having a lot of holes in it, the ammunition had exploded from the front turret. And part of the radio equipment had been nibbled at, and the throttle cables on the aircraft would all been frayed by flak, which, to say the least, made it difficult for the pilot. From what I remember, the Mick Martin even gave a lecture to the Americans who had taken this Elmas Field in Sardinia. Quite a man.
What impression did the Americans make on you?
They couldn't have been kinder. We found them wonderful people. They couldn't do enough for us. We buried Bob Hay, the bomb aimer. They were very kind. The commanding general, the American general, invited us to have a meal with him, which we did. They gave us all American clothing, because most of us were covered in blood and all sorts of things. They couldn't have been kinder. This has been our impression during the war altogether, that we got on very well with them.
Did you see much of them while you were in England?
Yes, quite an amount. Tell you an amusing thing. When I was flying with Joe McCarthy, the American, Joe was a great lover of Coke. And it was really quite funny because used to get maybe a navigator and a wireless operator and take a Lancaster off and fly to the nearest flying fortress base and roll up to the flying control tower. Leave the pressure on the hydraulics, you had to on the Lancaster to get the bomb bays open, and then just wait. And then next thing there'd be a knocking on the on the aircraft, and you'd go down and open it up, and then often only two people, sometimes three, would get out. And the Americans, it went something like, well, where's the rest of the crew? So we used to sort of play along with them and say, well, what do you mean? And they say, well, where are the rest of the crew in this aircraft, in this bomb, you see? And we used to have a lot of fun and pretending that the one crew member would run for the if the fighters came to the front, he'd run to the front turret, and then if they came to the side, he'd run to the mid up turret, and then run to the back. Anyway, to cut a long story short, this happened so many times, and they could see the funny part of it. And of course, at these American bases, they always had the American PX store where you could get things quite cheaply, which was quite good. So in actual fact, I flew with two Americans on the squadron, because at one stage I flew with Nick Nylands, who was in the actually my very last raid with Nick Nylands to went to Russia for the Tirpitz. We also had a visit from General Doolittle and General Peak.
Spatz.
General Spatz. Sorry, yes, General Spatz. And they were very, very impressed with the bombing record of the squadron, because we were getting as good results, if not better results, at night by using the SABS bombsight than the Americans were getting by using their Bowden bombsight by day. I think this surprised them a little.
On the question of navigation, when you were flying the 617, you said that you could sometimes assist the navigator by map reading and observation and so on. What was the main source of information for the navigator? Was it map reading, or would it be dead reckoning, or radio beacons, or G, or some other electronic?
All of them. The navigators very properly seemed to use everything that was going. We didn't have H2S on the squadron, but we certainly had G, and good use was made of G. Frankly, I found that the navigators on the squadron were really very, very good. Very, very good. Well trained. I think a classic example was the effort of the navigators on the on D-Day, where they did this spoof raid across the sea. That I think was pretty tremendous. I think the only way that I contributed that night was by throwing out window, which was I suppose it all helped.
How long were you at that?
I think from memory, I think about 6 hours, I think. Something like that.
Did you ever find that you suffered from fatigue when you were going on long raids?
No, I don't think so. I mean, quite frankly, the adrenaline was pumping all the time, and we were too busy to... I think that is a secret. I always pity the gunners who were just sitting there. I think they had the toughest job of the lot. I mean, apart from worrying about fighters, but I think they had the toughest time of the lot, because all they could do was just sit there. But at least we were busy, And if you were busy, it took your mind off the other things. But fatigue, no. It only hit you when you got out of the aircraft after you landed coming back. At least that's my experience. Don't forget, we were all pretty young and pretty fit. Incidentally, that's another thing. The squadron, very keen on fitness. We did an awful lot of... You did your own thing, but people wanted to survive. You survive by being fit and being efficient.
How did you keep fit?
I did an awful lot of running and swimming. Those are my two main things.
Was this track running or cross country?
Oh, just cross country, just bombing around.
You say you'd feel pretty tired once you got out of the aeroplane at the end of a raid.
Mm-hmm.
How long would it take you to recover from a raid and be fresh enough to go again?
Oh, after getting back and getting to sleep, next day you could go again. Say, you must remember that we were pretty young in those days. We were all, you know, around about 20, 21, 22. And, you recovered pretty quickly.
What about hunger? Did you suffer from that on long trips?
No. One seemed to have a pretty good supply of chocolate and coffee and things like that. No problem there.
Did you go on the dams raid?
No. No, I arrived immediately after that. I say it was one of those things. It just didn't work out.
Do you remember much about the Tirpitz raids?
Well, the thing that I remember, here again, I was flying with a scratch crew, with Lieutenant Nylands, who was flying with the Air Force, although he had transferred to the American Air Force and wore American uniform, etc.
Why had you done that? Why had you transferred to the American
Air Force? No, he had.
Oh, he had.
He had, I'm sorry. He had transferred from the RCAF to the U.S. Air Force. The thing that I remember about it was that I saw the navigators' maps, and they were of Russia, which were pretty poor. The signals information was pitiful. We frankly got lost going over there, and we had made up our minds to ditch in the rivers, of which there were plentiful rivers we were within about 60 miles from Archangel, and we had a 12,000-pound Tallboy bomb underneath, and let's face it, we were pretty lost. The weather was awful. We were down to just a few hundred feet trying to pick up a landmark, which unfortunately you couldn't because of the bad visibility. Nothing but an occasional river or stream and nothing else but pine forests all over. I say we had made up our mind to ditch. We'd got rid of the escape hatches on the top. And unfortunately, when we'd done this, all the engine covers that we'd taken with us on this occasion flew out the window. Target maps went out of the window. My brand new hat that I'd taken over specially to show the Russians went out of the window. And we just made up our minds to come in and ditch in the river when we saw another Lancaster. We presumed that he knew where he was, so we pulled up and joined him. I think he thought we knew where we were, so we were going around in circles. Anyway, to cut a long story short, we eventually saw a field that looked as though it may have been used as an airstrip at one time, and both landed there. It was near a sort of rest camp, as I remember, for the Red Army. I won't go into too much details about what things were like there. But...
What were things like there? What impression did it make on you?
Oh, pretty grim. The place itself seemed to have been built on a swamp almost, it seemed to be. You seemed to be walking on, most of the paths seemed to be made of trees that had been cut down. It seemed to be a pretty tough life, and I know there for the first time in my life I saw Red Army women who seemed to do exactly the same jobs as the men, but they looked more like men than men, but that's another thing. It looked pretty hard, but again they were kind and helpful as they could be, because they certainly never expected two Lancasters to come dropping in at the little air strip. Eventually I tried very hard to get through to Archangel on the radio, but never got any replies at all from the Russians. As I say, the information we had was very sparse. The radio beacons for trying to help with navigation, they didn't seem to work either. In fact, very little seemed to work. Eventually, Wing Commander Tate flew over to us. They must have got hold of him somehow. I presume the Russians at where we'd landed had contacted Archangel. And he flew over in a Dakota with lots of petrol, and we manhandled the, I think there must have been about 10-gallon drums of petrol, we manhandled them and filled the aircraft up. And then on takeoff, unfortunately, with the weight of the bomb still on, and the very short runway, we hit trees on takeoff, and damaged the aircraft quite a bit, and one of the engines was got slightly damaged, but eventually got to Archangel, and then we all worked on the aircraft as best we could, and then it must have been the next day, I presume, that we took off for the Tirpitz. So I remember, beautiful day. We'd been instructed to keep as low as we possibly could to avoid any radar pickup, which was difficult for us because shortly after takeoff, this aircraft that had been damaged by the trees began to act up, and I think it had to be feathered, which made things rather difficult. Anyway, things progressed, and as we got nearer and nearer the target, we could see the Tirpitz quite clearly. And then, unfortunately, the smoke canister started to work, and one or two of us managed to get a run in on at the Tirpitz and dropped our bombs. But by the time the last aircraft had gone, the thing was completely covered, and I think that the people aimed at the flashes from the battleship. The gun flashes from the battleship, of course, were firing like mad at us. At that stage, we didn't know whether we'd hit the thing or not. When we got back, we were greeted by a Russian band, as I remember, and welcome to the glorious flyers of the Royal Air Force, I think it said. And then we had to wait for the reconnaissance Mosquito to see what had happened. They came back and said the thing was still there, which absolutely broke our hearts. But of course, unknown to us, we had actually got it then. One bomb had knocked the guts out of it and finished it as a fighting unit forever. But of course, the squadron went back later on and finally sank it at Tromso, where I had the pleasure of going last year or the year before, I can't remember when, to meet some of the Norwegians who were involved at that time.
How long would a bombing run take on such a target from start to finish?
It it could take, depending on the target, obviously, but on a target like that, I should estimate about 3-4 minutes. And of course, that is always the vulnerable time flying straight and level when virtually the bomb aimer has control of the aircraft.